pulled on a wool rancher's cap with ear flaps. When they saw his mud and ice-encrusted pickup, the three of them paused for a moment and stared. Joe waved hello through the windshield. They waved back and moved on, hunched over against the cold. He noted that the three of them gave him a second look over their shoulder before they entered the rustic bar down the street. He knew that within hours the word would be out via the cowboys and the woman who lived next to Steve Pollock's former house. There's a new game warden in town. Chapter 9. Joe stomped the snow off his boots on a mat on the wooden porch and entered the central hallway of the Hotel Wolf. To his left was the doorway to a dining room filled with set tables and a wood stove glowing red on the east wall. Straight ahead was kitchen access and restrooms. A wide staircase to the hotel rooms was buttressed against a west-facing wall. To his immediate right were a pair of batwing doors. He pushed through them into a lobby of sorts with a pool table in the center and a counter near his left elbow. Beside the counter was an opening with a side view into the adjacent bar and a cooler filled with wine bottles and six-packs to go. The bartender looked up at him from where she was rinsing glasses. She raised a finger to indicate it would be a moment. He nodded back. There were two drinkers at the bar. One was a wide-faced man in his 70s with a bulbous nose who wore a polyester trucker cap that looked like he'd worn it long enough that it had come back into style again, and a hipster-looking dude with sun-bleached hair who appeared to have parked his surfboard outside in a snowdrift. Both leaned forward on the stools so they could get a look at Joe through the opening near the beer cooler. He nodded to them as well, and they sat back out of view. He heard the old man mumble something and recognized the phrases Game Warden and Steve Pollock. While he waited for the bartender, he checked out the room, which smelled of fresh popcorn from a half-full machine behind the counter. There were elk, mule deer, and pronghorn antelope mounts. He studied an old photo of the hotel looking exactly as it looked now, except instead of Joe's pickup out front, there was a stagecoach pulled by a team of six white horses. The inscription on the bottom of the photo indicated it had been taken in 1893. Joe liked the feel of the place. The bartender approached the counter, drying her hands on a towel. She was short and compact, and she wore a long-sleeved Henley T-shirt and tight western jeans. Her light brown hair was pulled back and tied with a red bandana. She had wise brown eyes with gold specks in them and a full mouth. Joe thought she had the presence of a woman who was friendly enough but didn't suffer fools. He placed his hand on the short counter. "Is this where you rent a room?"
"This is the place."
"I don't have a reservation."
"That's too bad, because we're booked solid until Christmas," she said.
Then, flashing a sarcastic smile, she said,
"I'm kidding. It's January in Saratoga. Except for the ice fishing derby weekend, we're wide open." "Just tonight?"
"Actually, I was thinking maybe a week." She arched her eyebrows in surprise as she pulled out a large ledger and flipped through the pages. Joe smiled.
"We're updating our software, so we're back to the old-fashioned method," she said by way of explanation. "What I'm looking for here is a room that's available for a week, so we don't have to move you."
"Thank you." She tapped on an open space on the page.
"How about number 9? It's a deluxe room with a queen bed, a TV, a tub, and a handheld shower. Overlooks Bridge Street."
"Sounds good," he said. He liked the idea of being able to look outside onto the main downtown street to see what was going on, if anything.
But I'll warn you, she said, we don't have phones in our rooms.
That's fine. Is there internet? She answered,
yes, when it works.
It's a deal.
As he reached for his wallet, she said, also, I need to tell you about the pedestal tub. It's old-fashioned, but it works perfectly. Just don't overfill it and thrash around. We had a very amorous couple here a couple of months ago who got a little excited. She nodded toward the dining room, and the bathwater dripped through the floor onto table number 7 directly below.
I'll try to stay calm, Joe said, handing her his state credit card.
Don't worry about that for now, she said with a wave of her hand. We'll settle up when you know for sure how long you're staying.
He thanked her and wrote, Joe Pickett, Saddle String, Wyoming, on the ledger. He glanced over her shoulder at the two customers to confirm that they were perched on the edge of their stools so they could hear. They were.
So, she asked, what brings you to town?
Oh, I'm here on a project, he said.
What kind of project?
I'm with the Game and Fish Department.
That's obvious, she said with a sly roll of her eyes. I don't mean to be nosy, I just asked because our last game warden just went away, literally. I assumed you were the replacement.
Temporarily, he said. There was no reason to explain further, and he didn't want to make something up. And my daughter works around here, he added. I'm eager to see her.
Good for you, the bartender said as she extended her hand. I'm Kim Miller. Who's your daughter?
Her name is Sheridan Pickett. Recognition flicked in Miller's eyes.
Silver Creek Ranch.
Yep.
Everybody knows everybody around here, Miller said. She's a nice kid, and I hear she's a good hand.
Good to hear, Joe said. And it was. Reputation in a small community like this meant everything. Kim Miller handed over a single key attached to a maroon plastic oval stamped number 9.
Take a left at the hallway at the top of the stairs. It's the first room on your left.
Thank you.
Can I get you something from the bar?
I'll wait.
I'll wait, she repeated. Those aren't words I hear very much around here, especially in the winter.
Oh, I'll be back, he assured her.
She looked over her shoulder at the taps, Stella Artois, 312, Deschutes, Dale's Pale Ale, Bud Light, Coors Light, and 2 beers from Black Tooth Brewing Company in Sheridan.
When I come back, I'd like a Saddle Bronc, he said. The brown ale was from the Black Tooth.
Good choice, she said.
The room was small, simple, and clean, and furnished to look like it might have looked when the hotel was opened. He hung up his uniform shirts and winter gear in a chiffer robe and kicked his empty duffel bag under the bed. He touched the warm radiator with his fingertips while he looked around. The bed was covered with a floral comforter. A Samsung flat-screen television was mounted high on the wall in a corner. There were 2 reading lamps and an overhead light and fan. An ancient transom was painted closed over the entry door. Joe texted Sheridan to tell her he'd arrived in town and that he could meet her in the bar if she was free. As he did it, he thought that he'd never before told any of his daughters that he'd meet them in the bar. She replied that she was just about done with evening chores and she'd meet him as soon as she could. Excited to see you, she texted, followed by a string of happy emojis. Joe was wary of emojis and texted back, me too. He rinsed his face in the antique sink, beheld the pedestal tub directly over table number 7, changed from his uniform shirt into a heavy chambray cinch cowboy shirt, clamped his Stetson back on and went back downstairs. The Saddle Bronc was waiting for him in a chilled glass on the bar.
Thank you, he said. Start a tab?
Sure.
He sat at a tall, narrow table that faced the bar. The hipster was gone, but the old man in the trucker hat sat hunched with his back to Joe, cradling a Budweiser in a bottle. The saloon was narrow and intimate. There were more elk, mule, deer, and pronghorn antelope heads on the wall, as well as University of Wyoming paraphernalia, and historical photos of fly fishermen and community fish fries. Sawdust covered the floor, and baskets of shelled peanuts were set on the top of the tables. Two mounted televisions were tuned to basketball with the sound off. There were 8 high-backed stools at the bar, and a long high table that sat 6, and a smaller round table that sat 4. Warm yellow light fused through the stems of wine glasses on the back bar. Cigars were for sale in a display case on the left side of the back bar, and packs of cigarettes were available on the right. An errant blue marlin hung from the ceiling and arched over the length of the room. Joe sat at the corner behind the long table and sipped the beer. It tasted good. He drew out his phone and sent a quick email to Allen's chief of staff that he'd arrived in Saratoga. Before he could text Mary Beth to tell her the same thing, Hanlon replied, "Getting there and getting results are two different things." Joe narrowed his eyes and did a slow burn. When he looked up, the old man had spun around on his stool and was facing him. His Budweiser rested on his right thigh.
"If you're not here to take over for Pollock, what in the hell are you here for? We've got enough government types doing nothing around here as it is. Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, Army Corps of Engineers, and that's not to mention the state government types like yourself."
Right to the point, Joe thought with a smile. "Did you know Steve Pollock?" Joe asked, deflecting.
"I avoided him the best I could," the man said. "But yeah, I knew him. Everybody knows everybody around here, even if you don't want to."
"Got it. Do you have any idea what happened to him?"
"You don't?"
"No." The old man raised his beer and drank it until it was gone. He ordered another over his shoulder.
"One more before rush hour hits," he said.
Kim Miller rolled her eyes for Joe's benefit while she dug out another bottle from the cooler.
"I got an idea, but I ain't saying," the old man growled as he reached behind him for the fresh bottle.
"Why not?"
"Because I ain't saying."
"What's your name?" "I'm Joe Pickett." The old man froze for a moment and turned his head to the side without taking his eyes off Joe.
"I've heard of you."
"Only good things, I hope."
"Some of them were. Are you the one that got involved with the Cates clan up north?"
"Afraid so." The extended Cates family in 12 Sleep County, including rodeo champion Dallas Cates, had declared Joe their mortal enemy, and they'd gone after his family. That had resulted in a slew of innocent and not-so-innocent deaths, and with both Dallas and his mother Brenda in prison for what would likely be the rest of their lives. Joe still had nightmares about it.
"Dallas was a full-on asshat," the old man said as he slipped forward off his stool. "I had the displeasure of meeting him once. You done good on that one."
He extended his hand to Joe. His grip was still cold from cradling the bottle.
"Jeb Breyer," he said. "I own the lumber mill up in Encampment."
"Nice to meet you.
Now, about Steve Pollock?"
Joe noted that Kim Miller was listening closely to the exchange while pretending not to do so.
"I got a theory, is all."
"Let's hear it. I haven't heard a reason why he's gone."
"He's got a lot of theories," Miller said. "Just don't ask him about 9/11 or the moon landing, or the last election."
Pryor ignored her.
I'll have to catch up with you later. I need to get to the mill before rush hour.
With that, he drained the bottle and placed it on the bar behind him along with a wad of cash. See you tomorrow, Miller said to him.
Pryor pulled on a heavy parka and grunted that he'd be back.
When Pryor left, Miller pointed toward Joe's empty pint glass and said, Another one?
Sure.
What was that about? Miller shook her head and said, We have a lot of characters around here. You just met one of them.
Again, a more compact version of Saddle String, he thought. And he made a note to himself to interview Jeb Pryor when he got the chance.
Rush hour wasn't, despite what Jeb Pryor said. Joe noted that there were a few more vehicles on the streets outside after five, and some locals parked out front and came in through the front door. Winter darkness had come suddenly, and the streetlights came on. He found that he'd inadvertently selected the catbird seat in the bar, where he could not only view all of the bar customers coming in, but people going to the dining room as well for an early dinner.
He could smell steak broiling from the kitchen. Kim Miller got suddenly very busy walking from the main bar to a service bar in an adjacent meeting room to take care of the dual crowds.
The batwing doors opened tentatively, and Sheridan stuck her head through the opening. When she spotted Joe, she grinned. He felt his heart swell at the sight of his oldest daughter, and he motioned her over and hugged her when she joined him. Sheridan looked slim, fit, windburned, and lovely, he thought. She wore faded jeans, Boggs boots, a cowboy hat that looked surprisingly good on her, and a down coat emblazoned with Silver Creek Ranch on the front. Her blonde hair was shorter than the last time he'd seen her. She smelled of hay and horses.
I got here as soon as I could, she said. My truck was due for an oil change, and it's in the shop, so I had to hitch a ride into town.
I'll be happy to buy you dinner, Joe said. We can sit in the bar or go get a table.
I'll be happy to eat it. I'm starved. It's good to see you, Dad.
It's great to see you. You look like a ranch hand.
I'm a wrangler, she corrected him. Who would have thought, right?
I think your mother has wrangler envy.
Sheridan laughed and said,
I know she does.
His daughter shed her coat and took a stool to the right of him at the end of the table. Sheridan, like Joe, didn't like to sit with her back to the entrance.
Let's eat here, she said, as Kim Miller arrived and slid a glass of red wine to her. Thank you, Kim, Sheridan said.
Miller nodded and went back behind the bar. Joe took a moment before he said, She didn't even ask for your order. Sheridan nodded and smiled.
I'm not exactly a stranger here, Dad.
Kim knows I like Shiraz. I usually come here on Friday nights.
Just like her mother, Joe thought.
He'd forgotten it was Friday, which, like in most towns in Wyoming, was a bigger night for socializing and going out than Saturday.
I think she wonders how long you'll be a wrangler.
You mean before I move on to a real job? She asked with a sideways glance.
Yep, I guess.
You can tell her, I don't know, because I don't.
That's what I'll tell her.
I'm making good money, and they give me a place to live on the ranch, she said. I'm doing better than most of the kids I went to college with, in fact.
You don't need to defend yourself, Joe said.
I feel like I do. I grew up with Mom always wanting me to help her with the horses and asking me to go riding with her. When I showed up at the ranch, I had a skill set they really appreciated. So blame her.
I'm not blaming anyone, Joe said. So let's move on.
Cheers to that, Sheridan said, and clinked Joe's beer with her wine glass and drank. This is a good place, Sheridan said, meaning the Hotel Wolf, especially on Friday night. Kim told me once that if you sit in here long enough, you'll meet everyone in Saratoga and everyone who comes through town. I thought she was kidding, but she wasn't. It's kind of like the heart of this valley.
Joe was used to having daughters. He'd never regretted not having any sons. But he wasn't yet used to having adult daughters. He looked at Sheridan sipping her glass of wine and saw her at 7 years old hiding Miller's weasels from him in the woodpile. She was obviously no longer that little girl, but her grit and determination were still hardwired. Mary Beth and Sheridan were both strong-willed, and clashes between them were inevitable. As Sheridan told Joe about her duties at Silver Creek Ranch and how happy she was there, more customers filtered in from the outside. Sheridan seemed to know them all, or know of them, and she kept up a low-running commentary for Joe's benefit. Of the three men in the Carhartt coveralls who'd taken seats at the bar, she said, "They're construction workers on the Buckbrush Wind Energy Project going up north of town. It's the biggest wind farm in the country, from what I hear. Those guys are semi-permanent around here because they're building so many turbines." Of the three ranch hands, two men and a woman who clumped in and took a table near the back, she said,
"Working cowboys, just like we have back home. The woman with them used to be at Silver Creek Ranch for a while, but she got drunk one night and tried to run her boyfriend over with an ATV. She missed him and wrecked the four-wheeler in the trees. I think her name is Nelda."
Of the older man who sported a white mane of hair and who appeared to be arriving for dinner with his wife and older daughter, she said,
"Ever heard of Klobosch Aeronautics? That's Dan Klobosch. He's a multi-millionaire who owns a mega house up on the hill and flies here in his Gulfstream jet. One of the women he's with is his wife, and the other one is his mistress. Apparently Mrs. Klobosch is okay with that."
Of the gruff man in winter outdoor gear who escorted a second man wearing a blazer into the bar, Sheridan said,
"He's a hunting outfitter working on his client, trying to get the guy to commit to a hunt. There's a bunch of hunting guides and fishing guides in the area, and they all compete for rich out-of-state clients. Tom there is one of the most successful guides around here because he knows how to wine and dine potential customers. Some of those other outfitters just have no interpersonal skills at all, you know?"
Joe turned his head to her and smiled. "I guess you know all about hunting guides," she said with a roll of her eyes. "I don't know why I was going on and on about them. But you see what I mean, don't you? If you sit here long enough, you'll get to understand what makes this whole valley tick. You've got your ranchers, your multimillionaires, your lumberjacks, and your hunting and fishing types. They all just seem to blend together and get along around here, which I find kind of fascinating."
Joe agreed.
Kim Miller swooped over and asked them if they wanted to order food where they were in the bar or move into the dining room. Joe looked to Sheridan for guidance.
"We'll stay here," she said. "The scenery's better."
What she said, Joe agreed, tacitly enjoying how his daughter had taken charge. Joe ordered a steak sandwich and fries, and Sheridan ordered a Kirsten's roast beef sandwich. While they waited for their food and Sheridan continued to point out new arrivals and regale Joe with gossip and stories about them, two large young men slipped into the saloon who didn't seem to fit any of Sheridan's earlier categories. The men were big and raw-boned, and they shambled across the floor in a loose-limbed way that sent off a signal that they were ready for anything, Joe thought. They had similar physical characteristics, heavy jaws, jug ears, powerful arms that strained at the sleeves of their coats. One had jet-black hair, and the other was a ginger. As they passed, the black-haired man assessed Joe coolly and shook his head from side to side with disapproval. The black-haired man led the other through the saloon into the meeting room, and the two of them sprawled in chairs and waited for Kim Miller to take their order.
"There's a guy who doesn't like game wardens,"
Joe said.
"Probably, but it's not that entirely," Sheridan said, sotto voce. "We're sitting in their place."
"How was I to know that?"
"You weren't, but I do," she said with a sly smile. "And we aren't moving."
"Who are they? They look like brothers."
"Exactly," she said. "They're the Youngbergs." Joe had heard that name before, and before he could recall it, Sheridan said, "Brady is the dark-haired one. He's the oldest by a couple of years. Ben is his little brother. They're farriers."
He nodded.
They'd also been mentioned by DCI agent Michael Williams as suspects in Kate's disappearance. "With all of the horses we have on the ranch, we need farriers to come out nearly every day in the summer," Sheridan said. "We've tried some other farriers from around the area, but there's no doubt the Youngbergs are the fastest, cheapest, and best. I kind of wish they weren't, because there's something about them when they're together that kind of makes me uncomfortable."
"In what way?" Joe asked.
"They look me over like I'm a piece of meat," she said. "And I've heard some things. Let's just say we actively try to keep them away from our female guests."
Joe felt a rise of anger in his chest. There was no doubt Sheridan was attractive, just like her sisters and her mother. But he didn't like the idea of two rough yahoos leering at her. The food arrived just in time. As they ate and talked, more people came into the hotel. Soon every seat in the saloon was filled, as well as most of the chairs in the adjacent meeting room. Kim Miller was slammed, but she moved into a higher gear and managed to keep up with demand. Joe nearly bolted from his stool when he saw Brady Youngberg make a grab for her hand when she delivered a third round of beer and shots to their table. Miller turned and said something fierce to Brady that made both Youngbergs blanch for a moment, and then laugh it off as she returned to the bar. She was too fast for them, Joe thought. His steak sandwich was perfect, and Sheridan ate her roast beef with determination.
"When you work outside all day," she said defensively, and he smiled.
"So," he asked Sheridan, after the next round of drinks arrived, "did you ever meet the woman from England who disappeared, Kate Shelford Longdon?"
"Oh, yes, I met her. She was really nice, and she loved to ride. And she wasn't one of those types who pretended she was an expert when she wasn't. I didn't spend as much time with her as my boss did, but she rode every minute she could, and..."
Sheridan stopped talking and suddenly looked at Joe with suspicion in her eyes.
"What?" he asked.
"She's the reason you're here, isn't she?"
"I can't lie to you. I just ask you to please keep it to yourself."
She nodded, but continued to appraise him.
"Maybe I can help," she said.
"I was hoping you could. I have a lot of questions, but I don't want to talk about it here tonight."
"I understand. Does Mom know?"
"Yep, and she's probably more interested in this case than anyone else. She knew all about Kate's disappearance."
"I believe that," Sheridan said.
"I can see Mom going all in on finding the missing British executive. That's right up her alley."
Joe agreed.
"Maybe we can get together this weekend," Sheridan said. "I need to work in the morning, but the afternoons are pretty open."
"Let's do that," he said. "I'll be in touch."
He watched her as she bent her head and finished her meal. Joe turned his plate so she could access his French fries, which she did. He could tell she was intrigued by the whole thing.
"Do you remember when you used to ride along with me and we talked about working together to solve a mystery?" he asked her.
"I was just thinking the same thing," she said softly.
Her eyes were moist when she said it.
"I always said someday we might do that, but I wasn't sure I believed it. But who knows?"
I'll keep it to myself, she said. But I'm warning you now, nothing stays a secret for very long in this valley. I won't say a word to anyone, but believe me when I tell you that everyone will know sooner rather than later that you're looking into the Kate thing. He nodded, just like Saddlestring.
They stayed for another 20 minutes as the bar got more raucous. It was crowded enough that it was difficult to have a conversation without being overheard by someone.
"I'd better get going pretty soon," Sheridan said. "I don't want to make my ride wait for me forever, and I know you're getting antsy with the crowd."
"You know me well," he said.
"I do."
"Who's your ride?" Sheridan blushed, then, "Let's just say he's insanely nervous that you're here. He might have heard a little about you from me."
"Ah," Joe said.
She excused herself to use the restroom, and Joe waited for Kim Miller to deliver the bar tab. He planned to leave her a very generous tip because she deserved it, and he thought she might be a very good person to talk to about Kate's disappearance as well.
The Denver Nuggets were hanging in there with the Golden State Warriors going into the half when Joe heard a shout from the adjacent room and the crash of chairs being knocked to the hardwood floor. Through a gap in the crowd near the door, there was a flash of Sheridan's blonde hair as she jumped back from the incident. He leapt off his stool and slid through the onlookers while clamping on his hat. He cleared the people choking the doorway and guessed what had happened. Ben, or Brady Youngberg, had left their table and tried to intercept Sheridan as she returned from the restroom. She'd fought herself free and stood facing them both with her back to the service bar. Both brothers had risen from their table quickly enough that their chairs had fallen over backward. Brady, the black-haired brother, bent over slightly at the waist and grimaced with short breaths. A tall, slim young man with a clean-shaven face and silver-belly cowboy hat stepped out from the tables in the room and stood in front of Sheridan. The cowboy was outnumbered and outweighed by 200 pounds if you combined both brothers.
"Get the fuck out of the way, Ramsey," Ben growled at the cowboy. "This doesn't have nothing to do with you. Brady just tried to talk to her and she kneed him in the nuts."
"I'll do it again if he tries to touch me," Sheridan said from behind the cowboy.
Joe instinctively reached down to his hip for the weapon that wasn't there, and the movement caught Ben's attention. Ben was obviously not aware what a poor pistol shot Joe was.
"Everybody calm down," Joe said. He could see no weapons on either of the Youngberg brothers, and Brady was temporarily out of order. "Let's all just take a breath."
"Who the hell are you?" Brady asked through clenched teeth.
"He's the guy who sat at our table in the bar," Ben said.
"I'll let you have it now if you'll both just relax and step back," Joe said.
"It's okay," the cowboy said to Joe with a nod of his brim. "I've got this."
"Brady can break you in half," Ben said to the cowboy.
The cowboy turned away from Joe and nodded his head as if he agreed with the statement.
"Maybe so," he said, "but I ain't moving."
Joe took a deep breath and walked over and stood shoulder to shoulder with the cowboy. He heard Sheridan whisper,
"Dad, don't get in a fight with him."
At the word "dad," the cowboy glanced over to Joe for a brief second before turning his attention back to the Youngberg brothers. His eyes settled on Joe's uniform shoulder patch and suddenly widened in reaction. He was nervous. The expression on his face was a mix of alarm and fear.
Ben said to Brady, "You all right?"
"Getting there," Brady hissed.
"Brady's getting his breath back," Ben announced. "When he does, we're going to take you two apart."
They looked very capable of it, Joe thought. Both had removed their coats, and their forearms looked like hams from the horsework they did every day. A low growl came from the direction of the kitchen. "Is everything under control in here?" Joe looked up to see a human bulldog of a man in his early 70s filling the doorway. He recognized the owner of the Hotel Wolf from the photos he'd seen in the lobby of the building. The owner wore a bloody white apron, and he gripped a meat cleaver in each hand. Apparently he'd been cutting steaks in the kitchen.
"I think we're all right now," the cowboy said.
"Ben?" the owner asked as he waved a cleaver in the direction of the brothers. "Brady? I've warned you before that I'd 86 your sorry butts if you caused any more trouble in here."
"We're fine," Ben said, suddenly conciliatory. "We're completely cool."
"Brady?"
"Yeah, it's over," he grunted.
The owner nodded toward them, turned on his heel, and strode back into the kitchen to cut more beef.
"This is Lance Ramsey," Sheridan said to Joe, after the Youngbergs had left the building and gone down the street to the rustic bar. "He gave me a ride into town tonight."
Joe recognized the name from William's files. Ramsey had been interviewed because he'd been the prime liaison with Kate on the ranch. He was also the head wrangler and Sheridan's immediate supervisor. Joe nodded and shook Ramsey's hand. "Thanks for standing up to them."
"My pleasure," Ramsey said with a shy grin. "I think they would have cleaned my clock without your help."
"They would have cleaned both of our clocks."
Ramsey blushed. He looked like a quiet, gentle, ramrod-straight caricature of what a shy but capable cowboy was supposed to look like. He could be Gary Cooper in his Helena, Montana youth, Joe thought.
Joe looked to his daughter, and she looked away. "Nice to meet you, Lance," Joe said.
"Nice to meet you, Mr. Pickett," Ramsey said. "Sheridan talks a lot about you."
Which explained the look of alarm and fear he'd showed earlier, Joe thought. Lance Ramsey was obviously more to Sheridan than her boss. Mary Beth, he thought, was right again.
Chapter 10. As much as it pains me, I have to say, I got a pretty good first impression of him, Joe told Mary Beth on his cell phone after saying goodnight to Sheridan and Lance Ramsey and going upstairs to his room to call her.
I wish you were here because you're better at reading people than I am.
I knew it, she said with triumph. I knew she was seeing someone.
And you were right. At least he's not a slacker or one of those hipster types.
He's not a metrosexual, she asked in a mocking tone.
He's a cowboy, Joe said. He looks like he walked in out of a movie. He really reacted when he met me. In a good way, I think.
I can't believe you're sticking up for him already.
Me either, Joe said. He doesn't say much, but he was there for Sheridan. He was always prepared to dislike any male who pursued any of his daughters. He'd been correct in spades when it came to April's choice of rodeo cowboy Dallas Cates.
Joe wanted to dislike Lance Ramsey. He really did. You were there to protect her as well, she said. I'm glad you didn't get into a bar fight on day one in a new place.
Me too.
As they talked, Joe approached the window that overlooked Bridge Street and pushed the lace curtain aside. Sheridan and Lance Ramsey were on the sidewalk on the way to a white Silver Creek Ranch three-quarter ton 4x4 pickup that was parked at an angle. Sheridan walked to the passenger door, but before she could get in, Ramsey jumped ahead of her and opened it for her. She slid in on the passenger seat. Then she turned and cupped Ramsey's neck with her hand for a moment and said something to him. Then she gave him a quick kiss on the mouth. Ramsey blushed red in the glow of the dome light and stared at his boots for a moment afterward before gently closing the door and shuffling around the truck on the ice for
for the driver's side. Joe felt heat rush to his face as well. Marybeth had been talking, but Joe hadn't heard a word. He wished he hadn't seen what he'd seen.
"Joe?" Marybeth said.
"Yep."
"Are you there? I asked you a question."
"I'm here. I just saw Sheridan give him a kiss in the street outside."
"Are you spying on them?" she asked, incredulous.
"Yep, and I wish I wasn't."
She was probably thanking him for defending her in the bar. That's kind of a rare virtue these days.
"That's what fathers are for," Joe said as he watched the ranch pick up back out and turn onto the street.
Before the dome light went out inside the cab, he saw a glimpse of his daughter's blonde hair through the back window of the cab. She had her head turned, and she was talking happily to Ramsey at the wheel. When the light went off, the after-image in Joe's mind was 7-year-old Sheridan sitting in the passenger seat of his game and fish truck during a ride-along 15 years before. She of the ponytails and missing teeth.
"She's 23, Marybeth said, reading his mind.
"So what was it you were asking me before?" he said.
"I asked how it was going so far."
"Complicated," he said.
10 seconds after he signed off with Marybeth, the phone lit up and burred. The screen read, "Casey Scales." Joe punched him up.
"Hey, I've got weird news for you," Scales said. "I went to my office to get the spare keys to the house over there, and I found out they're gone. I asked the receptionist about them, and she said she had sent the keys to Cheyenne about a week ago."
"To Cheyenne? You mean headquarters?"
"No, and that's where it gets even weirder. She said someone from the governor's office called, but she couldn't remember who it was."
"Why?" Joe asked.
"No idea."
"Someone from the governor's office wanted the keys to a game warden house in Saratoga."
"I know," Scales said. "Doesn't make any sense to me either. Where are you staying while you're there?"
"Got a room at the Wolf."
"Ah, good place. If I was you, I'd stay there and send the bill to LGD.
"Oh, I will. She can add it to my running tab. Still, I'd like to get in the house and see if I can figure anything out while I'm here,"
Joe said.
"I'll see what I can find out about those keys tomorrow, and I'll get back to you," Scales said. Then,
"Are you in your new house up in Saddle String?"
"Not even close," Joe said.
For the next hour, Joe lay on the bed with the reading lamp on and reviewed the Kate file again, hoping he would find something he'd previously overlooked. His eyes lingered on the names Ben and Brady Youngberg, and he circled them. The brothers had been aggressive toward Sheridan in a public place. What, he wondered, would they be like if they encountered a lone blonde British driver on the highway and thought they could grab her and get away with it? He started to get ready for bed when he realized he hadn't signed off on his bar and food bill earlier. At the time, he'd been so flummoxed by the encounter with the Youngbergs and meeting Lance Ramsey, he'd forgotten and walked out on his open ticket. He closed the door to his room behind him and locked it, then took the staircase down to the first level and pushed through the batwing doors. Kim Miller saw him and said,
"Here for a nightcap?"
"Here to sign my tab."
"Don't worry about it," she said. "I'll keep it running until you check out. Besides, I know where to find you." "Sure you don't need anything?"
"Maybe an ice water."
"Daredevil," she said, and winked.
While she filled a pint beer glass with ice, he noticed that the earlier crowd had largely dispersed and had been replaced with new faces. 4 men wearing coveralls and with Buckbrush Wind Energy Project embroidered on the breasts of their coats sat side by side at the bar nursing draft beer. Joe's gaze settled on a man and a woman at a table in the meeting area adjacent to the bar.
While the room had been almost full during the confrontation with the Youngberg brothers, the couple was alone in the empty room with their heads together, engaged in what looked like an intense conversation. They were dressed almost entirely in black, and they looked out of place in a town where denim jeans, sand-colored Carhartt canvas overalls, and puffy down jackets were the norm. Miller handed Joe his ice water and noted where he was looking.
"Mom," she mocked in a whispered British accent, "do you mind terribly if we smoke? And can I trouble you for a bar menu?"
"Ah," Joe said, as much to himself as to Miller. The man at the table looked to be in his early 30s, and his skin was so pale it was nearly translucent. He had short, spiked, silver-flecked hair and a long, pointed nose. He wore heavily scuffed black combat boots, tight black trousers, and a black peacoat over a black turtleneck. His long fingers were stained yellow from nicotine, and he was scratching furiously on a steno pad while the woman spoke quickly in low tones. An expensive camera with a long lens was on the table, as well as a small digital recorder, much like the device Joe carried in his own uniform breast pocket. She had red hair the color of new rust and a round face with a full mouth and green eyes. A light peach-colored scarf was knotted loosely around her neck to break up the blackness. Her left elbow was on the table, but her right arm was held straight down at her side, presumably to hide the cigarette in her hand from Miller behind the bar. Both looked up and stopped talking as Joe approached. Neither looked enthusiastic at the prospect of an interruption, he noted. Joe held out his hand and said, "Billy Bloodworth of the Daily Dispatch and Sophie Shelford Longdon. My name is Joe Pickett. I'm a game warden. Welcome to Wyoming." Bloodworth and Shelford Longdon exchanged a long, confused look, and Bloodworth said in a thick, throaty accent that was nearly incomprehensible to Joe's ear,
"Sorry, how do you know us?"
"I've read some of your work," Joe said.
"You're shitting me,"
Bloodworth said, unable to keep the pride out of his voice.
"Nope."
"So you know about Kate?" Sophie said. "We were starting to wonder if anyone around here knew about the story."
She paused for a moment, then, "or cared?"
"They know, and they care," Joe said.
"It's not the sensation that it is in your country, but people around here would like to find out what happened to her." She looked at Joe as if not sure to believe him.
"What does a gamekeeper do?" she asked.
"Game warden.
Unlike England, our wildlife belongs to the people of the state, not property owners. The state hires guys like me to enforce the laws and regulations and make sure there are plenty of healthy critters around. Most people in this state, and just about everyone in a town like Saratoga, have a freezer full of game meat for the winter."
"Barbaric,"
Bloodworth whispered to her. She nodded to Joe and ignored Bloodworth.
"Our hunting isn't like that."
"That's what I understand," he said.
"Our hunters are upper-class twits,"
she said with a curl of her lip.
"They shoot birds raised on farms, or they chase poor little foxes across the fields. They don't hunt to eat, they hunt for the sport of it. They're relics of the past, those so-called hunters."
Joe let it go. "Can I buy you two another drink?" She nodded, and Bloodworth said,
"Finally, a man after my own heart."
Joe turned to see Miller was already on it. "Do you mind if I sit down?" he asked. "It turns out we're here for the same reasons, to try and find out what happened to your sister Kate." Bloodworth took a long breath and screwed up his face as if he were about to object, but Sophie nodded toward an empty chair.
"We welcome any help we can get."
It's bloody cold out there to be chasing around the countryside by ourselves.
Joe nodded and agreed.
I thought I brought the right gear, but I could have used more heavy jumpers.
Jumpers?
You call them sweaters?
She corrected. Then,
what a horrible term.
He sat down as Kim Miller delivered a glass of white wine for Sophie, a pint of beer for Bloodworth, and another ice water for Joe. When she was gone, Joe said, "Officials in Wyoming assigned me to this case along with my other duties. Right now, trying to figure out what happened to your sister Kate is my highest priority. From what I understand, you've been here in Saratoga for a while?"
8 days, Sophie said. 8 very long and jet-laggy days.
Who are these officials? Bloodworth asked with barely contained derision. Are they the same people who didn't give Sophie and her family the time of day for months? Is one of them your Governor Allen, who acted like he didn't know anything about Kate when asked by the British ambassador?
Joe ignored him, just as Sophie had. Bloodworth, despite being a reporter, was not taking any notes. Joe turned his attention to Sophie.
It seems to me there's no good reason for us to work at cross purposes since we both want to find out the same thing.
I find this area primitive, but deceptively beautiful, she said as she took a sip. We've seen elk, bald eagles, deer, antelopes, and mooses, and a lot of beef cattle. Today we took the wrong road to Silver Creek Ranch, and we got stuck in the deep snow. Lucky for us, a local rancher happened by and pulled our car out with the chain he had with him. Otherwise, we could have frozen to death out there.
Fucking humiliating, Bloodworth grumbled into his beer.
Joe liked the way she said antelopes, mooses, and ranchers in her British accent. Sophie leaned forward and placed her hand on Joe's wrist.
The rancher looked at Billy and said, "Who's the fop?"
Bloodworth angrily looked away, and Joe stifled a smile.
"Who's the fop?" she said again in a faux American accent.
"You're lucky I know how to drive," Bloodworth said to her. To Joe, "She doesn't have a driver's license."
"If I did, I wouldn't get us stuck in the snow, Billy."
He shook his head.
"It's not like I've tooled around the countryside in a four-wheel drive beast the size of my house before, Sophie."
"So," Joe said to them both, "I just got here this afternoon. Since you've been here a few days, have you come up with any ideas about what happened to your sister?"
She said,
"We think we know who took her."
Joe sat back.
"Sophie," Bloodworth hissed, "we agreed to keep that on the QT until I broke the story. You agreed to that condition."
Sophie shrugged.
"Billy wants a scoop because his tabloid sent him over here. I want to know what happened to my sister."
"We're a team, remember?"
Bloodworth said.
"We're fucking aliens in this world. We need to stick together like we talked about."
"We've actually got a snap of him,"
Sophie said as she rapidly scrolled through photographs on her phone. When she found the one she was looking for, she turned the screen toward Joe just as Bloodworth reached over and pulled her hand away.
"Sophie!"
he hissed. But Joe had very briefly seen the blurry image of a man inside a home of some kind. The photo shot through a window from what looked like a great distance. The man stood in shadow in the background and seemed to be gesturing with his hands. In the foreground of the shot, near the bottom of the window itself, was someone's head, long, blonde hair. She appeared to be seated with her back to the window as she watched the man inside. The shot was so out of focus that Joe couldn't see the man's face, only his lanky form.
"Let me see that again," Joe said.
"Absolutely not," Bloodworth said. He'd taken Sophie's phone from her, and she looked away half embarrassed but completely resigned.
Is that Kate?
We're sorting it, Bloodworth said.
If you have evidence, you need to share it with law enforcement, Joe said. Bloodworth looked suspiciously at Joe, then said to Sophie,
Something happened here to Kate, right here, in this beautiful little valley. She didn't vanish on her own. Someone knows what happened to her, and we think we know who it was. We're not ready to reveal our findings yet. We don't know who we can trust.
Joe said, But if you've got proof that she's alive, wouldn't you want her rescued immediately? Sophie hesitated for a moment, and Bloodworth turned on Joe.
If these important officials are really trying to get to the bottom of this, why did they send a gamekeeper?
Game warden, Billy, Sophie said.
Whatever, Bloodworth said. The question still stands.
And it's a good question, Joe said. He didn't want to get into the backstory, because there are too many things about his circumstance that seemed hinky, and he knew they would sound that way if he tried to explain them.
And why should we trust you? Bloodworth asked. Give us one good reason why.
I'll tell you what, Joe said, pushing away from the table. I'd rather earn your trust than beg you for it. So I'll leave the two of you alone. I need to get some sleep so I can get to work early tomorrow trying to figure out what happened to Kate. If I learn something, I'll let you know. He stood and looked from Bloodworth to Sophie, then flipped his card down on the table. But if you really do suspect somebody, and that photo is real evidence, I hope you'll involve law enforcement right away. You may even want to call me. His eyes settled on Bloodworth. I hope this isn't all about a newspaper story, because people out here don't read the Daily Dispatch. Whoever you suspect probably has 8 guns, because that's about average.
8 guns?
Sophie asked with alarm.
Maybe more, Joe said.
I've never even seen one, except in movies, she said.
Ignore him, Sophie, Bloodworth said. He's trying to scare you.
Joe knew something was wrong when he saw a band of light on the hallway floor emanating from the partially open door of room number 9. He knew he'd closed it tight and locked it when he left. He instinctively reached for the Glock that wasn't there as he approached the door as quietly as he could. He paused to listen but could hear no stirring inside. Then Joe shoved the door open and stepped back. Nothing. The room had been tossed. Clothing was scattered across the floor, and his duffel bag yawned open from on top of the bed. The chiffarobe doors were open, and his uniform shirts and civilian cinch shirts were bunched on the floor where they'd been flung. He sighed in relief that his weapon hadn't been taken from where he'd placed it on the nightstand, but it had been moved to the other side. The Kate file was gone. His boots made a sound like thunder on the stairs, and Kim Miller looked over at him from behind the check-in counter with her eyebrows arched in curiosity. "Someone's been in my room," he said. "Did you give the keys to anyone when I was talking to the British couple just now?"
"Of course not," she said with heat. "We don't do things like that."
She was offended. He noted that from where he stood, he could reach over the counter and access the board where spare keys hung. Anybody could have done the same.
"I'm sorry," he said. "Did you see anyone suspicious a few minutes ago?"
She shook her head. "I was washing glasses and keeping my eye on Sophie trying to hide her cigarette from me," Miller said. "I wasn't looking over this direction because I didn't expect any guests this late."
Joe checked out the bar. Sophie and Bloodworth were gone. The 4 Buckbrush project workers were still on their stools drinking beer.
"I know I locked the door," he said to Miller in frustration.
"No one locks their doors around here," she said with a shrug.
Maybe that was the problem. 15 minutes later, after Joe had reorganized his clothing and gear and verified that the only thing missing from his room was the Kate file, he brushed his teeth, undressed, double-locked the door, and lay on his bed staring at the still ceiling fan. He doubted sleep would come quickly. It would have been easy, he thought, for someone to snatch the spare key from the board downstairs, mount the stairs and enter his room, toss it, and depart down the stairs and straight outside while Joe was engaged in conversation with Sophie and Bloodworth. Whoever had taken the file had been efficient and determined. They somehow knew who he was, why he was there, which room he was in, and what they were after. Random burglars would have left with his weapons and gear, after all. Those items had resale value. It was disconcerting. He thought about all the people he'd seen in the bar that night, all the strange and unfamiliar faces except for Sheridan. Word was already out, apparently, why there was a new game warden in town. Someone who knew something about Kate's disappearance had been down there in the scrum and overheard his talk with Sheridan. Whoever it was familiar with the wolf, knew about the board with the spare keys, and knew Joe wasn't in his room for the 15 or 20 minutes he'd been gone. Kim Miller, the quarterback of the Hotel Wolf Bar, seemed to be the most obvious suspect. His head told him,